as it can. Miranda July is also a writer of fiction. Her stories have appeared in the Paris Review, Harper's, and The New Yorker, and her 2007 debut collection, No One Belongs Here More Than You, won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award and has been published in 26 countries. In 2009, she designed 11 Heavy Things, an interactive sculpture garden for the Venice Biennial. In 2011, she wrote the nonfiction book It Chooses You for McSweeney's. In 2013, 100,000 people from 170 countries subscribed to her email-based art project, We Think Alone. And to show us once and for all that she can do anything she puts her mind to, Miranda July is here on Between the Covers to talk about her debut novel, The First Bad Man. Welcome to Between the Covers, Miranda July.
Hi.
Hi. Let's start with the novel as a form. If I'm imagining that I'm you, I'm thinking part of the attraction is I haven't done a novel before. So how was doing a novel different than your imagining of doing a novel?
Yes, that was the attraction. I wish it was something deeper, more profound. But a dare is pretty much like the level I operate at. I think in a way I thought it would be like the hardest thing I'd ever done. But because that's what everyone says, and people are always not finishing their novels and things like that. But none of those people have made a movie. And so I think actually it's hard, but it's a certain kind of hard that's very comfortable to me. It's all on me. It's all sort of this internal private process. And the hardness of making a movie is much more fundamentally uncomfortable to me. You know, you're hiring, you're firing, you're accidentally losing other people's money, you know. And so that was a surprise. I was like, oh, you know, theoretically, this could be something that I did. If I was the kind of person who did just one thing, this seems like something I'm suited to. However, I'm not. I definitely don't want to write a novel again as my next thing. But yeah, my husband commented like, oh, you seemed pretty happy during those 3 years. Yeah.
Well, when I was reading about the time when you lived here in Portland and you were developing your performance art, that you really tried to shy away from internships, that you wanted to keep this idea of how to do it right away from you as you figured it out for yourself. Is that also true now, decades later, with writing the novel, that you wanted to grope your way through writing a novel on your own terms? Or did you seek out people as editors and readers like you might with a film project?
Right. I feel like at this point, while I'm still that same kind of person who doesn't like look at a book and think, well, I want to do something like that, like just out of my own weird DIY pride, I come at it thinking like, well, luckily I'm the first person to ever write a novel, so it's just wide open, you know, like this. Obviously, I know that's not true and I'm a massive reader, but I do kind of isolate my brain a little. And yeah, I have a really high tolerance for notes and feedback at this point because that's such an integral and unavoidable part of making movies. So I relied a lot on friends and feedback, and some friends read many, many drafts, and that was invaluable.
And then did you start with a conception of the type of novel you wanted to write, or were you someone who started with an image or a scene or an emotion and then built your way forward?
Right. Well, I did actually start with an idea, which I sold to Scribner and wrote about, you know, 60 pages of. Then I made my last movie, The Future, and I kind of realized through that process that this idea I'd come up with wasn't gonna work. It was too personal, and there's nothing like playing playing someone who's your type of person. You know, I wasn't playing like a working class British woman in my movie. I was playing someone who you could imagine might be something like me, whether or not she was. Nothing like that to like make it clear all the all the pitfalls of that. And I felt really free in the parts of the movie that were more surreal or just not so much about me. And this original novel idea was drawn from my true life. So I had then a very clear idea of what I wanted. I wanted the type of story in which I could never play any of the parts, and that should have some surreal element. I mean, I literally had a list like you might have for your like future life partner, you know, on your dream board or something. Like, he should be self-supporting. He should, you know. And then I just like waited, and it did come like all at once. And the whole Cheryl Klee, you know, I say all at once after years.
Well, if you were to, let's talk about Cheryl Glickman, the protagonist of the first Batman. If you were to introduce Cheryl Glickman to our listeners or to another person, who is she? What is she about?
She's a woman she's 43. She lives alone. She's always lived alone. Maybe has she ever had a relationship? Doesn't seem like it. And so she has all those sort of systems that you accrue when you live alone, your kind of ways of doing things. And she has a lot of pride about that. Like, she's not, she may seem pathetic to like her coworkers, but she actually has a fair amount of righteousness about like the brilliance of her own methods.
Can you talk about Cheryl's system? Like, what, because she works for a self-defense nonprofit for women.
Right.
And yet she also seems very defended, essentially. Yeah. And defended in her, as you say, righteous, but also alone. And her life takes on a sort of Baroque ritual quality to it.
Right. And I should add, she's not a knowing character. She's not the kind of person who would use the word gender or something, despite the self-defense nonprofit. Like, she somehow managed to miss the entire, like, sexual politics, all of that. Her systems I relate to a lot. It's essentially like the idea of keeping the house clean all the time by almost not living in it, like having just one set of dishes, you know, so that they can never build up. And ideally, like, not even using them, just eating out of the pan, which I do when I'm working at my office. Carpooling is a term I coined that maybe we'll catch on, as applied to like, if you need to bring something to another place in the house, like you're putting back a book or something, that you wait until you have a lot of other things that need to go in the same direction, you know, just for efficiency.
So what really rattles Cheryl's world is when she sort of gets cajoled into taking her boss's daughter as a roommate, who's a 20-something feral sort of character. What I found really fascinating about their relationship is I sort of expected, okay, this is going to be an odd couple roommate scenario, but they end up finding love through a very unexpected method of enacting the self-defense videos. And literally, you can't, at least for me as a reader, I could not imagine them finding a connection through words. They physically wrestle their way to love, essentially, is the way it felt to me. I wanted to hear about that role playing as a way of connection, the way of sort of approaching a connection obliquely, whether that was somehow a philosophy for you or a methodology for you when you created art.
Right. I think I was unconsciously interested in that, exactly what you're saying. And I remember the point in the book where I wrote the word surrogate, which I eventually took out because it was too knowing of a word for Cheryl. But I realized, oh, this idea of standing in for something else or role playing as a way of being more honest and more present than you could be if you were, like, quote unquote, being yourself, was really powerful. And if I could somehow get at that and have people using that who were not part of like a community of people into playing roles, you know, but who were doing it very much in like a self-invented way and for mundane reasons. I mean, she gets into it as a like cure for a health problem she's having. It's definitely not sexual, I guess, for her. She's not aware of that anyways. We also didn't mention that Klee is like her physical opposite. She's like the kind of blonde, busty bombshell that like stops traffic, which is a weird thing to contend with as another woman, as any other kind of woman. Yeah.
I know you don't like to talk necessarily about themes in your mm-hmm. work. I've noticed you've said that before in interviews, but it does seem like a recurring theme. Like when I think about the short story Mon Plaisir, where a couple that is on the rocks sort of finds a way to find themselves as a couple again by becoming extras in a film and then play acting. And similarly, I would even say like your new app, the Somebody right. app, which is a strange way to use technology to have real people in real time play act your text messages to someone they don't know.
Right. I did especially like once I was done with a novel and working on Somebody, I was like, oh, here's a really good example of me being interested in one thing and doing it, approaching it in two completely different mediums. Didn't know if anyone would pick up on that. It's often said like, oh, all your work's about connection. And that to me feels a little wrong. I'm more interested in the, because that implies like people are really connecting, you know, they're really like knowing each other. And I'm not sure that's even really possible. It certainly doesn't happen in my work. But what can sometimes happen is the strange ways people go about it, you know, by, you know, playing a role that's the opposite of them or something, are often so revealing that they have a tenderness to them that is kind of more present and open than, you know, than what we think of as like the proper way to aim for intimacy. And that's so interesting to me. That's like art itself, the way that each person comes up with their own very misguided path to connection, you know, and then the connection is usually very fleeting. I mean, even in that story, Mon Plaisir, like it seems like their whole romance might be able to restart, but it's really just there, just when they're doing that scene and not again. Yeah.
Do you use role playing or specific constraints when you're doing your writing also?
I thought you were going to say like in my sex life or something. I was like, wow. yeah, when writing.
Well, you could say yeah. it while writing in bed. If
that. Yeah, which I do. You know, it's interesting. I think this gets at like this very subtle definition of role playing that I've been trying to figure out how to articulate. It could just be a way of saying, how do you get somewhere without going straight towards something? And I certainly do that in writing. You know, if I know that I need to make a character more, have more pride, if I've over humiliated them, I don't go straight towards pride and think like, what is it about pride? How can I capture that? I take a left turn towards something that happens to be interesting to me, and then I find a way to get there through that wrong thing that nonetheless has a beating heart, or else it wouldn't be interesting to me. And okay, that's a stretch that's role playing, but I think in general we get stuck so often because we think the right path is the straight one, that we're being like really good if we just keep on trying to, you know, do our work by sitting at our computer and looking at the screen, you know, like, I think there's a sort of tyranny of A to B. and so I think, yeah, in this book, I was often trying to show like, look, like a baby was made in this book, but like how it was made, like it's almost impossible to trace the path, although that's one of the most fundamental processes. Like there's no other way to make a baby, right. Really. Ultimately, it's right. Like the sperm and the egg. But I really try to believe in this book that it could come about through one woman's fantasies, really.
Well, there's that weird paradox that sometimes fiction feels like it's getting at a deeper truth than nonfiction, and the weirdness of assuming the role and delivering the lines that maybe aren't your lines in a script that someone else has given you as being a way to liberate yourself towards yourself sort of points at how our own self narratives are scripts also.
Right. And basically anything that allows you to be present, which a script might do that more because you're like, oh gosh, here I am. I feel nervous or my heart is beating or whatever, you know, might allow you to be more actually there with everyone than the script that you're always doing.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today to Miranda July about her debut novel, The First Bad Man. Miranda, let's talk briefly about the main male character in the book and what he serves in terms of the narrative. So talk about Philip and what you see him doing in The First Bad Man.
Yeah, he was such a secondary character for so long, and I was like, oh, I don't want this guy, this kind of creepy guy in there, but he serves an important purpose all the way through. And gosh, I don't know. I feel like I'm like about to fail a test on my own book.
Well, I can yeah. Speak to something about him that I thought was really crucial to the book.
Okay, good.
And you tell me if
and then I will repeat that forevermore.
Okay, well, tell me if I'm off base. But Philip is who Cheryl's A to B script wants to be with, right? So like if she could live her life directly based on her own self-conception, she wants to be with creepy Philip, who is on the phone with her often, trying to get her permission for him to have sexual relations with someone who's underage, essentially.
Right.
But I feel like the thing that really serves the book is it sort of contextualizes that even though all of these things that Cheryl ends up really doing in the book are things she could never have imagined doing, that they're not what Philip's doing.
Right.
Like it almost feels like it gives her the permission to make some leaps.
Right. Wait, what do you mean they're not what Philip's doing?
Well, that maybe what Philip's doing involves some ethical concerns.
Right.
And
right.
Hers don't really, hers are unconventional, but are not necessarily moral questions.
Right. It's true. So he sets her in relief in a way that is pretty useful, because you get kind of nervous, like if she's on his side and he's like pretty alarming, you know, where's this going to end up? And it goes to all these weird places, but yeah, they're not, they're all allowed. And if you can be open to them, yeah, maybe positive.
Well, let's have you read a little bit from the novel. Do you have a section in mind?
Yeah, let's see. This is good because speaking of Philip, this is early on in the book, and they really actually don't know each other that well. They're talking on the phone, and she's just had a crush on him for so long, and is just like thinks with each phone call, maybe this is the call where he's gonna also confess or going to confess his love. I'm sorry, said Philip. I didn't call when I said I would. I guess I was just scared. Of me? Yes, and also society. Can you hear me? I'm driving. Where are you going? The grocery store, Ralph's. Let me ask you a question. Does age difference matter to you? Would you ever consider a lover who was much older or much younger than you? My teeth started clacking together, too much energy coming up all at once. Philip was 22 years older than me. Is this the confession? It's related to it. Okay, my answer is yes, I would. I held my jaw to quiet my teeth. Would you? You really want to know what I think, Cheryl? Yes. I think everyone who is alive on Earth at the same time is fair game. The vast majority of people will be so young or so old that their lifetime won't even overlap with one's own, and those people are out of bounds on so many levels. Right, so if a person happens to be born in the tiny speck of your lifetime, why quibble over mere years? It's almost blasphemous. Although there are some people who barely overlap, I suggested. Maybe those people are out of bounds? You're talking about babies? Well, I don't know, he said pensively. It has to be mutual and physically comfortable for both parties. I think in the case of a baby, if it can somehow be determined that the baby feels the same way, then their relationship could only be sensual or maybe just energetic, but no less romantic and significant. He paused. I know this is controversial, but I think you get what I'm saying. I really do. He was nervous. Men are always sure they'll be accused of some horrific crime after they talk about feelings.
We've been listening to Miranda July read from The First Bad Man. Since we're on the topic of gender, of course there are men who do multidisciplinary, multi-genre, innovative, avant-garde work. But when I think about a lot of the vital stuff that's going on, and I think of like Sophie Cal or Marina Abramovich or you or Sheila Hetty or Chris Krauss, I'm often thinking of women. And I wanted to pose this question to you of whether that's just saying something about me and where my focus seems to be, or whether you think this is a particularly vital time for women in the avant-garde.
I don't know. I mean, I'm with you on that. Of course, I feel like I'm so enmeshed in, you know, like, well, of course it seemed that way to me, you know, like Sheila Hetty's one of my best friends, like all the, you know, and those are the people I'm like looking up. And, but I will say that there's a lot more support happening among women in power now. Like, we're supporting each other in a way that wasn't happening for me in, like, even through, like, Riot Girl and all that stuff. And for a long time after it, I felt very alone. And it's a little bit because of the internet, like, because it's easy to do. But it's funny, I'll notice, like with this book, like all these women rushed in, like powerful women, and like retweeted and tweeted about it and, you know, seemed really determined, like, we're going to help Miranda on this one, you know, like, and I know that feeling so well, you know, there'll be like some obscure book of poetry and I'll think like, okay, I may not be Lord, but I can really help this, this woman, you know?
Right.
And I also know a lot of men, but actually, and they're all nice people. None of them did that.
Huh.
I just thought about that today. Like,
that's really
they just didn't. And I don't think it's like they're thinking about it. I just think the women know how meaningful it is, and that it's not just like a co-marketing thing or something. It's like really political, like standing by each other thing, because also everyone's getting a little bit knocked down too, you know?
Well, it feels like the women that I mentioned in the who are doing multidisciplinary avant-garde work are also foregrounding the issue of gender. So like gender is actually part of what they're examining in their art also. So I could see why that would be something that people would want to
Right.
Support.
Right. Yeah. It's inherent to the work. Yeah.
I wanted to segue to talking about a question I had about gender and how your work is received. Because when I, just in preparing and reading other interviews of you, it's almost invariable that people talk about the polarizing nature of your work. That it reminds me of my wife's French and the way French people are received in America. Like, you're either like super into French culture or you just find it super annoying. Mm-hmm. And similarly, it feels like there's people who are like really strongly in the Miranda July camp. And then there's people who are for whatever reason, feel really like adamantly irritated by mm-hmm. by your art. And I wondered if that was a gender double standard. And I liked Lauren Groff's piece in the New York Times. I'm guessing you've mm-hmm. probably read it, where she looked at the meaning of the word whimsical and felt like it was dismissive specifically around gender. And that resonated with me. I was wondering, you know, would Michel Gondry or Wes Anderson have it quite the same way as Miranda July? I know they're polarizing also, but maybe not quite in the same way, not as unrelentingly so. And so I was curious what your take on that is.
I mean, sure, those guys are called twee and whimsical, and you know, even Dave Eggers is, you know, for all the like hard work he does in the world. But there's this thing of annoying that I think is specific to like women in power who aren't playing up their sexuality, you know, or somehow not fitting the exact mold, whether it's just sort of an energetic thing, you know, or physically. And they're unapologetic about that.
That makes me think of Lena Dunham.
Who... Right. Sure. And she changed the landscape quite a bit. I mean, since the last time I had something out, things have changed. And frankly, it's so much for the better. You know, like the thing of diminutizing a woman, you can't get away with that in the same way anymore. It's not just her. I'm sure it's just, you know, there's waves of culture and
it also seems like it is one of the upsides of technology, like what you mentioned, that we can create, or women can create narratives before they get created in the larger culture through social media that right. actually end up creating larger narratives.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like you can surround something and make it like proclaim it like safe, you know, or hands off or something, and carry it into the world, you know. Yeah, so I have to say, I think it's shifting a little bit. I also think the polarizing thing was a story that was picked up by the press. And I knew it happened because I, for example, with that New York Times, there was a New York Times magazine cover about me, and the interviewer was lovely, and we had a great time together. And then the piece was completely slanted towards like she's loved, she's hated, and you know, quoted some barely existing blog called like I Hate Miranda July or something. And I remember talking to her later and being like, wow, I was sort of surprised that was the through line. And she said, you know, that was one tiny part of what I wrote. Mm. And my editor pointed at that and said, there, that's the story. And
so it's possible that we think of this as half-half, and that really this is a media-generated phenomenon that's self-perpetuating, that I'm participating in unwittingly.
Yeah, I mean, because the truth is, I always sort of feel like saying, well, I feel pretty lucky. I'm making a living doing exactly what I want. It doesn't seem like people who hate me, you'd have to give them a lot of air time and space and mental space for that to be equal to people who are passionate about something. Because frankly, I mean, you just don't care as much about the things you hate.
Sure.
So I kind of think it feels different to me now. I remember my husband saying, you were right. You said this is going to pass, and it seems like it is passing. Yeah.
In the last several years, you became a mother. Motherhood is one of the themes in The First Bad Man. Can you talk about what some of the themes of motherhood you felt ended up in the book, and maybe how they related to things that came up for you that you hadn't experienced prior to being a mom?
The original idea for the book had a baby in it. I didn't have a baby yet, but I thought I probably would have one in the course of the time of writing the book. And so it was like a little, gift for myself. Like, I know nothing about babies now, but I assume this is a topic I'll be interested in over this time. And it was true. I was writing in the hospital. I was like taking little notes, I think partly because my whole life had changed. And the only thing that made it through the divide, it felt like, was the book, you know, like I can at least carry this book into this new land where everything else is just screwed. That's how it seemed initially. And so I wrote tons of stuff for the book and thought, oh my God, now this book's going to become very, very personal. And then I moved out of that phase. And ultimately what stayed was a few sentences and kind of the beating heart of like a writer who actually knows what she's talking about when, you know, when she writes fiction about motherhood. Yeah, I got farther and farther away from my story and, you know, came back to being Cheryl's.
One of the ways that people would categorize your art is as social practice art. And you've collaborated with Harold Fletcher, who teaches the art of social art and social practice at Portland State in the past. Could you describe what that means to you, what social practice art is? I know it's not entirely specific to writing a novel, but as the novel as part of your larger career. But.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, God, Harold could do a really good job of this. I mean, I feel like, you know, I often just say I do this whole category of work in a few different mediums that's participatory. Because for me, it's social practice often to me is work that is in a community, but is no less fine art. You know, it's like deciding that you could take a guided walk with a group of people and that would be the piece, you know, that it doesn't have to be this picture on the wall. It can be like a living engagement with people and that is object enough. I'm sure no one has ever described it that way before. It's sort of a blasé definition. But certainly that was something we had in common, or we were coming from different, you know, well, I just almost called Harold about 9 different names, the name of my son and my husband. And then,
that's book tour.
For yeah.
Do you feel like the online store that's related to the novel is a nod towards social practice and sort of community engagement? It feels like what happens between Cheryl and Klee is a strange form of social practice art, even though that's not really what they're doing. But the store feels like another way, like another mode that one could approach living in the world of the novel.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, have these art ideas that I kind of just slip into the marketing territory because it's a way to get something out there and test out if it'll work. And this idea of a store as a piece of art, I'd been thinking about that for a while. And yeah, I love that it's participatory, that it's using like real money and real objects, and people can, you know, only one person is ever going to own each object. And it's a kind of intimacy that doesn't relate at all to fiction. Like with fiction, you all read the same book. You all own the same book. So the idea that one person might own the cup that's in the book is just wrong. And I think I kind of enjoy that the writer part of myself is like aghast. Like, what? There doesn't need to be the cup. I just need to write the cup, you know, those words. And then I like kind of messing with that and being like, really? Why? Why is it so precious? I'm curious, you know, maybe it is precious. Maybe I messed it up. I mean, I enjoyed even those fears. Yeah.
There's something you said that stood out to me in an interview you had with Rachel Kushner and Baum. You said, the whole time I've been building my audience, I've also been trying to unbuild the walls that come with having an audience, with having power. And I wonder if part of the reason why people always say that your work has to do with connection is around this dynamic, desire for the person who's receiving the art to not just be receiving, but to be participating. So in a sense, maybe something around permeability,
right,
is more apt.
Yeah, exactly. And I, I do, on maybe just a psychic level, try and do that with my books and movies too. Like I, you know, I'm believing, I'm really thinking about the audience. And I don't know how it comes through. It probably doesn't, and that's why I end up doing these actually participatory works. I think the feeling of being in an audience is so uncomfortable to me. I think I associate it with listening to my parents. You know, like my parents are sort of monologuers, and and that feeling of being kind of trapped and stuck and unseen. And you know, it's not like it was some form of torture, but you know, everything I do runs the risk of being like that, right? I am asking people to listen, so I think that's why it feels so necessary to me. Like I don't want to put people in that position where they are supposed to lose sight of themselves and get lost in my world and then feel bereft.
For people who are really taken by your work, by whether your novel or your performance art or your interactive sculptures, what are some of the people you would point people towards? I know, like when I was young and I was, you know, I'd get an album, I'd read the liner notes and be like, oh, that person, you know, he was studying the guitar of so-and-so. Then
right.
I'd go to the next band. Who are some people that you would, either were touchstones for you in formative years or people that you're really jazzed about now that you would direct people towards?
Well, I'll go off right now. I'm reading a book, a brand new little book by the playwright and director Richard Maxwell. It's called Theater for Beginners, and it's a book for actors, but it's also one of those soon to be classic books that you could also just replace actor in every sentence with person. And I've been finding it like strangely moving. It's like pocket size, so I keep it in my purse. Dovetailing with that, I've been using the meditation app Headspace a lot. I don't know if you, it's probably like the most popular meditation app, and I would never have thought that was even a good idea. It seems like a very bad idea, but in fact, it's helped me keep it up in a way that I haven't. And this, you know, I've done many different kinds of meditation retreats, and it's been profound for me this year. What else? I just finished Ben Lerner's book, and
I've been wanting to read that myself.
Yeah. I'm just lugging it around because I finished it, but super interesting. And that's called 10:04, and the one before, Leaving the Atocha Station, is really incredible. That's kind of what I just discovered. The filmmaker Roy Anderson has a website. He's Scandinavian of some sort. Is he Swedish? He's in his late 60s, and I really love his work. It's not super easy to get at, but he's still really making movies. He just won the top prize at Venice, and you can look him up, and there's a lot of stuff to look at online that's really interesting.
And is there a next unfamiliar form that you're attracted to? Like, I've never done this, and there's a charge around it somewhere on the horizon?
I kind of think from now on it's pretty much just all going to be permutations of other things. But new things get invented. I mean, apps didn't exist, you know.
Do you have a project that you're working on?
Yeah, yes. I'm doing a few things. I'm working on a big public art project that'll happen in London next year through an organization called Art Angel. And I have a new performance called New Society. That's a very audience participatory performance that I'll be doing over the course of the year in a few cities, and I'm working on my next screenplay.
Wow.
Or so I say.
Well, it's great having you on Between the Covers, Miranda.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We're talking today to Miranda July about her debut novel, The First Bad Man. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 38th Annual Portland International Film Festival, which begins February 5th with a screening of Wild Tales at the Fox Tower and continuing through February 21st at many locations all over Portland. This year's festival brings over 150 films from around the globe to the Portland metro area. Again, that's the 38th Annual Portland International Film Festival, running through February 21st. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Piña Flamenca, Eric and Encarnacion's Duo Flamenco, on Saturday, January 31st at 8 p.m. at Cafe Artichoke in Portland. Eric and Encarnacion's Duo Flamenco will present traditional and original compositions and dance numbers, including new, unreleased songs rooted in the deep tradition of flamenco. Again, that's Piña Flamenca, Eric and Encarnacion's Duo Flamenco, on Saturday, January 31st at 8 p.m. at Cafe Artichoke, 3130 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information about the event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in to KBOO Friday, January 30th at 8 p.m. for a 13-hour celebration of Alan Lomax on his 100th birthday.
Get on board, little children, and ride with me. This is Alan Lomax, your ballad man, inviting you for a ride on the folk song train, the train that runs wherever the people sing, wherever the people make their music.
KBOO hosts and special guests will be playing excerpts from Alan Lomax's long life of field recording. We'll play radio shows, field recordings, interviews, and more. That's the Alan Lomax Centennial Celebration with 13 hours of special programming, Friday, January 30th at 8 p.m. to Saturday, the 31st at 9 a.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Caroline Miller. Ms. Miller is a playwright here in Portland, and she's written several novels. Most recently, she's created a stage play called Woman on the Scarlet Beast. Ms. Miller, thanks very much for coming in and talking to me.
I love these little encounters we have, Don. This is our second, and I hope we have more.
Okay. Ms. Miller, I guess the first question I want to ask you is, we last talked in 2012. You had just finished your novel, Trompe L'Oeil. Since then, you've launched a web-based book review series and a few other things. Tell me about that first. I mean, what made you want to review books online, and what types of books do you tend to want to talk about?
Well, we talk about fiction. The program is Just Read It. It's a 10-minute YouTube interview, of which you've been on, Don, right? And we tend to do books that are bestsellers or that have a local color, so they'd be interested to local readers here in the Oregon area.
Mm-hmm. How many of them have you done so far?
We've done 8. 4 are up, and the next 4 are in the can, and probably the first one of that series will be up by the end of this January.
So what you said that the books may be bestsellers or books that have a local color. What is it that made you want to review books online in the first place?
Oh, gosh. Can I be brutally honest with you and the audience and still keep it our secret? We do it because we're pushing our own books. You know, it's a way to get known. And it's also fun. But that wasn't what started it out. We were promoting ourselves, but it turned out to be a heck of a lot of fun.
So then a lot of those books that you are promoting are books from local authors?
Some of them are, but some of them are bestsellers.
Okay. You were also a semifinalist in the Portland Center Stage Playwright Competition called Jaw. Tell me about that.
Well, that was quite a while ago. It maybe was in the 90s. I've been working on this play. I started writing it in the 1930s.